From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. As the U.S. struggles to contain the coronavirus, let's go now to Southern California. L.A. County, the nation's most populous county, had its highest single-day tally of new cases yesterday, bringing its total to more than 100,000. Governor Gavin Newsom has ordered bars in L.A. County and six others to close. Here he is explaining that decision at a briefing yesterday.
Many people were not necessarily being as responsible as they otherwise, well, as we would like them to be as it relates to social distancing, people that weren't wearing their face masks. We need to take further steps, and that's exactly what we did by closing down some of the areas of concern.
Several other counties were advised to follow suit. As you may remember, California was the first state to institute stay-at-home orders and worked aggressively to curb the spread. So what's gone wrong? Let's bring in KPCC health reporter Jackie Fortier. And Jackie, today Anthony Fauci in testimony said there's going to be a lot of hurt if people don't follow guidelines. Is it as simple as saying that when there was a slight opening, people just abandoned protections and so we're seeing the spread a few weeks later?
Well, I mean, that's definitely part of it. It correlates pretty clearly to the lifting of restrictions by the state, which, you know, allowed sectors of the economy to reopen. Governor Newsom initially proposed a much slower approach, but after getting a lot of heat from businesses and faith groups, he decided to reopen much faster. And he also left a lot of the decisions about which businesses could reopen up to individual counties. So we had this really weird kind of patchwork for a few weeks where, you know, hair salons were open in one county, but they were closed in others. And that messaging really confused people. We had, you know, public officials reopening businesses, but at the same time telling people to stay home. There was also a lot of confusion on the business side. They didn't understand what their responsibilities were as far as, you know, making people wear face masks or letting people into the store depending on the business, because those were different depending on the county. So with businesses reopening, people, especially young people, took that as a sign that it was safe to go out, gather with friends or family. And our cases and death rates really started rising 2 weeks later.
Well, and there's also resistance. We saw the video of the woman in a Trader Joe's screaming at people who are asking her to wear a mask to come into the store. To her, it was a political issue. These were Democrats, you know, who were, you know, taking her rights. How big a factor is that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that video was in Orange County, which is a neighboring county to Los Angeles County. They have a lot more Republicans elected there, and they have been pushing back on the mask mandate quite a bit. We're now seeing cases rise in Orange County, which is kind of changing the conversation there. You know, recently they decided not to push back against the governor's mask order, for example, because their cases are increasing dramatically.
Well, back to L.A. County, the director of health services said the daily number of new cases there could be up five times the peak of what L.A. County experienced in late March, early April. So it's not just coming back, it's coming back with a vengeance, and it could drastically burden the healthcare system. So what's the hospitalization rate? How close are hospitals to reaching capacity?
Yeah, well, L.A. is California's COVID-19 hotspot. It is the most populous county in the state with more than 10 million people. But when you control for that, the infection rate is very high. Health officials announced yesterday that one in 140 county residents, they estimate, are infected and out and about. They're not isolated. Hospitals in L.A. could run out of beds in the next 2 weeks and ICU beds sometime next week. We were told at a press conference yesterday by county health officials that hospitals are prepared. They're ready to implement their surge plans, and that would include canceling non-emergency operations and turning other parts of the hospital, like the emergency room, into COVID treatment areas.
Well, we spoke of people who think this is a political issue, and Governor Newsom tweeted, "California's response to COVID is based on science." Then there are people who might accept that, but think that they're just not vulnerable. And that's, of course, young people. We saw a lot of pictures of them on the beaches, at bars. Is there a sense that they may shift their behavior?
Well, I mean, we can look at the data. Most of the growth in cases is in young people. In LA County, 40% of the new cases are in people under the age of 40. When businesses began to reopen, people just didn't take it as seriously. And we don't have the numbers that was seen on the Eastern Seaboard. I mean, California is a very large state. Most people don't know anyone who has gotten sick or died from it. So they just really didn't take it as seriously.
Well, and here we're coming up on the 4th of July weekend. Beaches closed in L.A. County, but not in the rest of the state. So this might be an example of what you were saying. It's patchwork.
Yeah, exactly. You know, fireworks displays are canceled in most places, as are any gatherings. So hopefully people keep that in mind and, you know, stay apart for this 4th of July.
Jackie Fortier, health reporter for KPCC. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Well, the legacy of President Woodrow Wilson is back in the news. The Democrat was twice elected president, and here he is campaigning in 1912.
The nation has awakened to a sense of neglected ideals and neglected duties, to a consciousness that the rank and file of her people find life very hard to sustain.
Wilson was talking about ideals and opportunities that he himself did not apply to all Americans. His racist views recently led Princeton University to remove his name from its School of Public Policy. Julian Zelizer teaches at that school. He is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Julian, welcome back. It's good to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, we have you on to talk about history's intersection with the news every week. And this time it's hitting close to home. What do you think? Do you support the school's decision to remove his name from the school?
I do support the decision. And I'm someone who was uncertain when this first emerged in 2015. In the end, I concluded there was enough there based on his personal and policy record to justify the move, and that enough had been brought to light that leaving the name in place itself became a statement. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to deal with institutional racism, that includes the names of buildings and the monuments we keep.
Well, let's talk about some of his policies that got us here. As president, he segregated the U.S. Civil Service. That was an agency that had been integrated for decades. Tell me more about what he did there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most controversial part of his record that came to light. He segregated it after it had been integrated. And at the time, civil rights leaders criticized him for it, including the newspaper editor Monroe Trotter. There were other elements of his presidency that we've been discussing, such as his showing Birth of a Nation, a film in the White House, a film that was an ode to the KKK. And other ways in which he, like other presidents of the period, basically lived with the system of racial apartheid that existed in the South because Southern Democrats controlled Congress. So there's all aspects of the presidency, some more direct than others, where his record on race is not great.
Princeton University's president said in an op-ed in the Washington Post in the last couple of days that he doesn't pretend to know how to evaluate Wilson's, these are his words, staggering combination of achievement and failure. Julian, how do we judge historical figures who are often a combination of good and of evil?
Well, it's difficult, and that's why this case is different than Confederate statues, for example. And I think we deal with them in two different ways. When we're writing books or when we're teaching in the classroom, I do think we try to capture and cover all elements of a person, all elements of a particular leader. For Woodrow Wilson, there were parts of his record which were quite progressive, such as economic regulation and supporting a League of Nations, and others that were very regressive, such as his record on race and free speech during World War I. But when it comes to monuments and the naming of programs, that's a different question. It means, what are we commemorating by having that person on the front of a building? And in a given moment in history, what does it mean to keep that name? And I think that's the debate we're having. And at this moment, it became clear that this was the decision to show a commitment to racial equality and toward a new era of civil rights politics.
And as you said, this is not the first time it came up. Back in 2015, students were asking the president to change that name as well, to bring it down. But he didn't listen at the time. The name stayed. But what do you make of the moment now where things are changing so fast?
Well, look, there was a vigorous debate back then, and in the end, the administration kept the name, but the movement's accelerated. I think this time the debate emerged when there is a movement on the streets, when there is a national debate as a result of the last round of videos that's even more intense than it was in 2015, when this era was really getting underway. And so I think the politics changed. And I think the way we look at the name of this program and other monuments that are going to be discussed is just different. Mm-hmm. And that's totally fine. And that's how these movements work.
Do you think the movement's here to stay?
I think it can have an immense impact. I don't know where this goes, but I do know that in the 1960s, social movements had a huge effect. The civil rights movement changed the national conversation about race. The anti-war movement changed the conversation about Vietnam. And this movement has the total potential to do the same. Mm.
Julian Zell is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
As we eye a future with no end in sight for the pandemic, it's hitting a lot of people. Travel, as we know it, is over for a while, not just within the U.S., but around the world. Starting tomorrow, Americans and others from high-case countries are not allowed into European Union countries. The U.S. is one of the worst hit by COVID-19, along with Brazil, India, the U.K., Spain, Peru. But what if you had some sort of magic pass that would let you travel, go back to work, get into buildings without taking your temperature? Some governments, including Chile, the UK, Germany, Italy, and the US, are considering issuing immunity passports, a digital or physical document certifying that someone has immunity to COVID-19 because they had it and have recovered, as hundreds of thousands now have. But wait a minute, is that true? Does that give you immunity? And what ethical questions are raised when there are tiered COVID-19 privileges, like the fast lane at an airport? These people would sail through life, skipping quarantines, going to work, traveling. Well, among those raising the alarm, the WHO, and Dr. Alexandra Phelan. She's a researcher with the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. Her new article in the journal The Lancet is COVID-19 Immunity Passports and Vaccination Certificates, Scientific, Equitable, and Legal Challenges. And you can throw in practical as well. Dr. Phelan joins us now. And start with the basic science. With some infections, say chickenpox or measles, an infection does generally confer lifelong immunity. But with others, like the seasonal flu or colds that are also caused by other coronaviruses, it doesn't. You can get the cold again. So what do we know about the antibodies you get after COVID-19 infection?
So even in diseases we're quite familiar with, immunity is a very complex concept. So whether certain indicators in your blood or in your, you know, bodily fluids, whether they actually tell us if you're immune or not is a bit of a complex process. And with SARS-CoV-2, that's only exacerbated, not only because it's an emerging disease, so we're still learning a lot about it. But as you said, with coronaviruses, whether you have lasting, lifelong or long-term immunity is a little bit more challenging. What scientists are looking into is once you've had an infection, does that then mean that you actually have that sort of immunity? You actually have an immune system reaction and a reaction that then whether what we can detect in your blood or in your system, certain types of antibodies or certain types of proteins or certain cells, whether that actually then correlates to actual immunity. It's kind of the first step. And then how long does that last is information that we still don't quite know. Now, it's likely that infection will result in immunity, but we still have a lot more to find out about how strong a reaction you require and how long that immunity lasts.
Well, let me jump in there because two questions. First, there's that study recently out of China published in the journal Nature Medicine suggests that recovered COVID-19 patients get only about 2 to 3 months immunity. It starts to fade after a while. And then there's the question of whether the tests for immunity are even accurate.
Yeah, so say that we know that the presence of a certain molecule in your blood would indicate that you are immune. The next question is also whether the tests that we have are actually accurate to reflect whether you have that antibody or not. And this is one of the big challenges with immunity passports because any certification is going to be reliant on that test. So you might take a test and it says that you are positive for these antibodies, right? And so let's say we even know that that means you are immune. So we've gotten quite down the path of scientific understanding here. There's a possibility that that is a true positive, that it's correct and that it accurately reflects the fact that you have that antibody and you are immune. Or it could be a false positive. It says that you as an individual, you have this antibody, you are immune. And so you go, great, I've got my certification and I go out in society. But it turns out that that test wasn't quite accurate. And you then potentially are putting yourself and others at risk because you actually aren't immune and you could fall sick and you could potentially transmit it to other people.
All sorts of questions, but go to the ethical questions. This could be the way employers decide who can work, who doesn't work, who gets to travel. You write that this could compound the existing gender, race, ethnicity, nationality inequities, but also that it might be an incentive for people to get sick, to try to get sick so that they could get a passport. Take up some of those ethical questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially what an immunity passport would do, as you say, is it creates this artificial restriction on who can and can't actually participate in, not just work, economic activities, but also social activities. We've seen the pressure of these of reopening and how people want to re-engage with their friendship groups and their family, and also civic activities. We're in an election year, obviously the timing would matter, but there are many parts of society that an immunity passport would essentially determine who can and cannot access that society. And as a result, that does create this perverse incentive. That is, it encourages people to want to get infected, to get that antibody test and get that certification so they can get back into society. And in some respects, that pressure, that economic pressure, particularly for already vulnerable populations, have been disproportionately affected not only by the actual health impacts of COVID-19, but also the socioeconomic impacts of COVID-19. That incentive to, to roll the dice if you can't even feed, if you can't feed your family, of course you'd take that risk. I think people can understand that. The real challenge, and I think for policymakers, is to not try and find these sort of silver bullet solutions, because things like this perverse incentive, it's not simply just a matter of somebody's perhaps sick for a couple of weeks and then great, they get their immunity passport and off they go. We are still learning so much about this virus and how this disease affects people, and the long-term impacts of this disease are not insignificant. We're seeing long-term lung damage, potential interaction with other diseases as well, and chronic illness long-term. And so that incentive carries a really negative weight that we really need to consider, because it's not just a matter of getting the common cold and moving on with your life. We know that already vulnerable populations, particularly, as you said, Black and brown communities in the United States, are having more severe lethal outcomes from this disease. And that is a result of systemic injustices in terms of accessing healthcare, in terms of the conditions for good health and well-being beforehand, that society has failed to provide and address these injustices. Mm. One of my additional concerns is not only that sort of perverse incentive entrenching inequities and inequalities and potential long-term health damage, but like all privileges administered by governments, immunity passports are at real risk for corruption and further implicit bias. And that means, who can actually get a test? Who has access to tests? Who can access the certification process for the test? And then also, whose tests, whose certification, whose immunity passports are actually accepted? Because just having an immunity passport doesn't mean that there isn't going to be further systemic injustice in how that is viewed and interpreted. So there's a real complex layer of the potential impact that these passports can have on entrenching injustice.
All right, we're going to just briefly say it could lead to such discrimination, because suddenly you have people who could never get an immunity passport because they have other, issues that would just take them out of the pool for immunity passports. And then suddenly you just have this two-tiered world.
Absolutely. I think something that is often forgotten in these discussions about the immunity passports is that this inherently creates indirect discrimination against individuals who cannot engage in putting their health at risk, elderly populations, people with chronic illness or persons with disabilities, pregnant women. These are individuals who can't just take up that potential perverse incentive and get infected. And so as a result, this is sort of an additional layer of discrimination that is essentially compounding discrimination against groups who are already subject to not being able to access many parts of society because of policies and the way things are structured. Catherine Olivarius has written about historical immunoprivilege during the 19th century when yellow fever was in New Orleans, and certain people were able to, you know, go get infected so that they could then continue to work, and that fell along largely racial as well as socioeconomic lines. And so that immunoprivilege, what's really worrying about that is how that compounds existing discrimination. The law does currently attempt to cover certain individuals and their health status, but it's not appropriately defined really now to be able to cope with this idea of immunoprivilege.
And by the way, for those who are saying, and many probably are at this moment, well, what's the difference between an immunity passport and a vaccination certificate, the ones that are required by the WHO and, you know, countries? You say it's a completely different idea. A vaccination certificate is an incentive to do something healthy, not an incentive to do something dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a considerable difference between, say, an immunity passport and a vaccination certificate in the sort of risk that an individual takes on. If I want to demonstrate immunity, I have to go get infected and then hopefully get treated and recover and be okay. If I go get a vaccine, that is something that has safety and efficacy trials. For me individually, it's much less of a burden and a risk, but it also has a big impact on my risk to other people. If I get infected to get an immunity passport, I could potentially infect other people, whereas if I get a vaccine, I can't infect other people. And really that incentive that you mentioned is vaccination certificates incentivize individuals to go and obtain vaccination against the virus, and that's a social good for everyone. In contrast, immunity passports are incentivizing, you know, going and getting that infection, which is actually a threat to others and also a potential long-term burden for the individual.
That's Dr. Alexandra Phelan with the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. We'll link you to her article on immunity passports in the journal Lancet at hearnow.org. Dr. Phelan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We all know the demand for food delivery is skyrocketing since the pandemic closed restaurants and bars, forcing many of them to rely on takeout and delivery for their livelihoods. Even with restaurants opening again in parts of the country and closing again in some states because of the rise in COVID cases, food delivery is still a hot sector. And today, reports that Uber is in talks with Postmates to buy that food delivery company and combine it with its existing service, Uber Eats. For more on this overture, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on member station BPM. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
I'm good. And some might say, well, what do I care about this? But these are not business stories you bring us. This is a story about how we're living. So what do we know about these discussions between Uber and Postmates?
Postmates has the option. I mean, it was seeking an initial public offering as a way to kind of raise money and maybe take venture capital investment dollars off the table. But if you step back, writ large, the whole sector is looking for some sort of rationalized business model. You can't just count on venture capital money to forever subsidize food delivery, because what we're seeing right now is a lot of money being lost. Restaurant margins are being crimped. Users are feeling guilt and they're seeing sticker shock. So Postmates has already raised more than $900 million in venture capital money, and it was last valued at $2.4 billion. And if you're Uber, you're probably looking at trying to thin the competitive herd in the United States from four major players to three.
Well, we remember when Uber Eats wanted to buy Grubhub, that fell apart, and the European company Just Eats bought Grubhub instead for $7.3 billion. So are they going to have better luck with Postmates?
I just think Uber right now is a little desperate because its core business is suffering. In the ride-hailing business, people have been standoffish about that during the pandemic, but it's looking to be a logistics solution if you're Uber. And whether it's a passenger or a bowl of General Tso's chicken, whether you have drivers, whether it's automated, it wants to be in that space.
Yeah. Well, and to talk about the space, you mentioned the ride-hailing business. That's faltering because of the pandemic, food delivery booming. And that means, you know, it's a change in our lifestyles. But for some restaurants, these food delivery services are keeping them alive, but also they have high fees charged by these services. So what do you think the future is for restaurants and food delivery?
Restaurants, I mean, are complaining left and right that they can ill afford to part ways with, you know, sometimes upward of a third of the check when they're looking to make rent and reduce payroll. So you're seeing more of them pursue some sort of self-determination, whether, you know, incent you to drive up for contactless pickup and even discounts if you download and use their own delivery apps. But they know that restaurant customers are only going to download so many apps. There's kind of a bloat on your smartphone at a certain point.
Yeah, well, another cost might be that California still has Assembly Bill 5, which classified drivers as employees, making them eligible for minimum wage, the right to unionize. So there might be another cost for these companies. But bottom line, I mean, this is the way we are living right now. We are ordering out and delivering food.
Yeah. And, you know, companies like Uber, like Postmates and the others, they want to be known as technologies, as platforms, as market makers, as benefits to society. But there is a dark side to that. They depend on human labor. And though there is an overabundance of cheap labor right now, you're seeing demands for hazard pay, maybe increasing espousal of a $15 yeah. minimum wage. So the gig economy has its yeah. dark side as well.
Fascinating to see where this goes. With Robin Farzad, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
New coronavirus cases are surging in many states, and so is the demand for testing. Houston's two public testing sites were overwhelmed before noon yesterday, and a site at the Major League Baseball Stadium in Tampa ran out of tests an hour after opening Monday morning. For months, public health officials have said that testing and contact tracing will help stop the spread of COVID-19, but as you can see, it has not been easy. Eric Paraxilis is a faculty member at Duke University, and he joins us now. Eric, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I see that you're helping the state of Utah develop a testing infrastructure that can be rolled out quickly. Why don't you start by telling us what you're doing there?
Sure. What we're doing in Utah actually has some infrastructure, but what we're trying to do is improve both the content and the timeliness of reporting from under-resourced areas. So a lot of these systems were set up to report minimum name, address, type information, contact information, test result. It doesn't always include ethnicity. It doesn't always include other attributes that could actually be really useful, especially when you consider that it's testing data that leads to contact tracing. And that's why people talk about test and trace. It should be a continuum of inquiry and care as opposed to being very separate events.
Hmm. There's a new analysis that researchers at Harvard did for NPR that found just 9 states are doing enough testing to keep their outbreaks under control. You know, big picture now, why are we still falling so short?
I think that despite trying to ramp up an infrastructure, I think first and foremost, there are still supply issues. You know, manufacturers are making tests. They're making the disposables and the reagents and the swabs and things for tests, but we're still behind. Also, some states simply didn't try to get enough in the first place. I think different, you know, policy has shifted. Human behavior has shifted during this epidemic. So I think some, unfortunately, are playing catch up on that. Ideally, this stuff would be handled and coordinated nationally, and it's not. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's very much who bought what from whom and when, and who can get what from whom and when.
I'm sure you've seen the pictures in these hard-hit states like Florida and Texas and also in Arizona, where people are waiting in tremendously long lines at these testing sites, some people lining up at midnight, only not to get a test at like 10 a.m. in the morning. That cannot be the best way to do this, is it?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, and I'm sure everybody is trying, but first and foremost, I think better guidance on when and how and who should be tested needs to come from all public health authorities. And when you can't win by numbers, I think you have to win by strategy, which means really thinking about who vulnerable people are. Because in some ways, you don't want the most vulnerable people standing in lines with other people that might be infected for hours. And really triaging up front in a very clear way who should be going where and when to try to be tested.
The country's top infectious disease doctor, Anthony Fauci, on the White House Coronavirus Task Force, said that task force is considering a method called pool testing. What is that and would it help?
Simply put, pool testing is simply when you take the samples from multiple patients, put it into one tube and run it as one test. And, you know, it's fine if it comes back all negative. But if it comes back positive, then you actually have to go individually test those 10 patients to find out which of the patients had it in the first place. The issue with it is that I don't know that it's the most effective thing to do in a peak, in a surge. Where it seems like it will be most useful is, for example, testing the staff routinely in a nursing home, given that 40% of the deaths are coming from the elderly. You know, you could be testing your healthy employees. If one tests positive, then you could test all of them. So it's a smarter way than random sampling to do testing. But when you've got a lot of sick people lined up for tests, I'm not sure that's what Dr. Fauci means as the best way to solve that particular problem.
Another issue we've been hearing a lot about as we've tried to figure out how to reopen our economies is contact tracing, getting in touch with people who are diagnosed and then see who they've been in contact with. But is that even possible now at this stage in states like Florida and Texas, where the outbreaks appear to be widespread? I mean, is it just too late to be doing that?
I think it's too late to get ahead of it. In some cases, I would say yes. The most important thing is that it's local. If you think about what contact tracing is meant to do, it's meant to illuminate chains of transmission, how it got from person A to person B. If they're doing that and everybody that they're communicating with is either already positive or already sick, the contact tracing in that area is behind the curve and you need to shift to a different approach. If we could ask 5 questions up front, when every patient receives their positive test result, you could actually probably cut 30% of the contact tracing because you would know what to do. I would be looking at who is living with somebody who's the elderly, who's a healthcare provider, who has a cancer patient living in their household. I would really use the conversation to prioritize care. That's when there's a shift. In some ways, a lot of people think that contact tracing, and it is, it's about measurement and determining things, but it's also an intervention if it's done right. It's also a chance to get ahead and say, hey, is there something, how do we know who to prioritize tests for? How do we know who to prioritize care and beds for? As opposed to just trying to identify every chain of transmission in an area of Florida. I'm not sure that numbers wins. Again, I think strategy is going to win over numbers in those places.
That's Eric Paraxilis, a faculty member at Duke University. Eric, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, some colleges have already said they're not holding in-person classes this fall because of COVID-19. Other schools have put off the decision, and that has some college students wrestling with whether or not to enroll for the fall or defer until they can be sure to have a full college experience. From member station KUOW in Seattle, Eilish Shoneel reports.
This spring, Abby O'Young was a junior at Pomona College near Los Angeles when the school announced it was closing and everyone had to leave.
I was helping my friend pack up her room, and she turned to me and she said, Abby, what if we don't even come back in the fall?
It's a question college administrators themselves are asking. The Chronicle of Higher Education is tracking what colleges are planning for the fall. Most schools are planning on in-person classes, but others, including Harvard, all the campuses of California State University, and many community colleges, plan to hold classes online. Other schools are waiting to make a decision. Pomona's in that camp. Administrators say they'll make an announcement in July, just 2 months before classes are supposed to start. And O'Young says she was not impressed this spring when she was living back at her mom's house in Seattle taking online classes.
Everyone I know was just like, texting during class or like scrolling through Facebook, or like we would have group chats with like our classmates about how boring the class was.
And O'Young adds, what about all the learning that happens outside the classroom? Meeting with classmates in the library or having dinner at professors' houses? Or for a student athlete like O'Young, on the golf course?
If it's online, like what are you paying for? It's a waste of my time and a waste of my mom's money.
Thinking like that is a big problem for a lot of schools.
How many students will actually show up in the fall? That's the huge, huge question.
Scott Carlson covers college finance for the Chronicle of Higher Education.
The deposits look good. That means that the students have plunked down a few $100 to secure a spot. That's not a guarantee of anything.
Carlson says the whole situation is putting colleges in a precarious financial position. Endowments have taken huge hits. Declining enrollment could be a death knell. Some colleges have already closed their doors permanently because of the pandemic.
I think once we get into August, you'll see a lot more.
Some schools are trying to deal with the question of uncertain enrollment by taking a tough line against deferment. University of Washington President Ana Marie Cauce says If an admitted student decides not to enroll this fall, they'll have to reapply.
You know, it's not that we're doing anything differently because of COVID that we've instituted any new rules, but rather this has always been the way that we do things.
But it's not just schools that are worried about money. Angie Aguirre-Tobar just graduated from Kennedy Catholic High School in Burien, a suburb south of Seattle. She's headed to Brandeis University in the fall. She's been dreaming of college since she was in elementary school. She'll be the first in her family to get an undergraduate degree. So when COVID-19 started to change what college might look like,
it's earth-shattering. When you have a set bullet list, it's kind of like that ink that you wrote down is completely blotched over. Someone spilled water all over it.
One of the big things Aguirre-Tobar is worried about is money. A big part of her financial aid package is work-study, an on-campus job Brandeis would give her. But if school isn't in person, she's not sure the college will have a position for her.
My family is not financially strong enough to really pay a lot.
Aguirre-Tobar says if Brandeis can't give her remote work, she'll keep her current job at a warehouse. She says she's starting college this fall no matter what.
I would continue to power through. I want to graduate in 4 years in 2024. That is my goal.
That's even though she won't know what Brandeis plans for the fall till early July. For Here and Now, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Seattle.
And we want to take a step back now to look at the backstory of one of today's headlines, the reports that Russia paid Taliban fighters to kill U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Now, there are questions about briefing material and what the president knew, but another question is, why is Russia in Afghanistan after a disastrous 10-year invasion in the 80s when the Soviet Union tried and failed to install a communist-backed leadership in Afghanistan? Marvin Weinbaum is director of Afghanistan and Pakistan Studies at the Middle East Institute, former State Department analyst. Marvin, just remind us of that disastrous decade for the Russians. Some say it led to the fall of the Soviet Union.
Well, initially, of course, going in December of 1979, they hadn't really expected to stay very long, but it stretched out, as these things will, over 10 years. And they blame us for having to give up the enterprise in 1989. So what's really involved here and subsequently is sort of revenge and payback for what they experienced, both having to exit Afghanistan and then the very fall of the Soviet Union in 1992, which they blame on the United States, and particularly Putin blames on the United States. And that's a large part of understanding what Russia is up to these days, is it has become very personal for Vladimir Putin.
So the Soviets had a disastrous, humiliating defeat that took down their economy and essentially maybe took down the Soviet Union with the U.S., yes, pushing from the side. Now, as you say, payback, after watching the U.S. go into Afghanistan and make some of the same mistakes that made it a long slog for the U.S. in Afghanistan, why would they be paying bounties, though, to Taliban fighters? The Taliban is the group that came out of the many different militia groups that were fighting the Soviets in that war. Why would Russia pay Taliban fighters to kill American troops?
You know, it's part of a larger program that they've been conducting over the last 2 years particularly. And that is one of making our mission in Afghanistan as difficult and as costly as possible. That's part of the payback. They want very much to see the United States depart Afghanistan. But it's interesting because at the same time, they don't want to see chaos either in our wake. And that is of concern to them because they are concerned about a radical Islamic government in the southern neighborhood that they exist in.
Yeah, in fact, Russia last year offered to be the guarantor of a peace deal between the U.S. and the Taliban. But when you talk about their support of the Taliban, we're reading as early as 2014, it was noted of Russia's weird interest in the Taliban, as it was put in some reporting then. And for years, General John Nicholson, the former head of the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, accused Russia of supporting the Taliban financially, providing weapons. Let's listen.
We've had stories written by the Taliban that have appeared in the media about financial support provided by the enemy. We've had weapons brought to this headquarters and given to us by Afghan leaders and said this was given by the Russians to the Taliban.
Well, Russian officials, of course, deny all of these allegations. But Marvin, explain something else. Yes, Russia may want to now humiliate the U.S., but Russia also has some geography to consider. I mean, they don't want destabilization in this area because it's kind of right on their border.
It is. It is that. Also, among those concerns, of course, is narcotics. And a Afghan state that is out of control, that is in chaos, they see as giving opportunity here for the drug traffickers. I think what has to be added here is that they want at the same time, and it's a large part of their relationship, is they want to establish links to the Taliban in the event that the Taliban should assume, if not full power, then at least partial power. They want to be able to be players in the region when the United States has left. They're very much interested as a kind of hedging strategy, that there be lines of communication with the Taliban so that they can come to some understanding which would be able to take into consideration their concerns in the region.
Yeah. If in fact it's true, it's proven, it's one thing to want to have an impact in a region. It's another thing to pay for American soldiers to be killed. What, in your mind, happens now if that's proven to be true?
It will undoubtedly strain further U.S.-Russian relations. I don't think there's any questions about it. But I don't think it's going to have any real impact on the peace process in Afghanistan. And I say that because that has its own dynamic. And our difficulties with Russia over this issue will certainly influence our cooperation in promoting a peace process, which is something that we have done together because we do have some common objectives into wanting to see a power-sharing relationship. But as far as getting the negotiations on track and having any influence on the outcome, I think this will be a peripheral issue.
Marvin Weinbaum, Director of Afghanistan and Pakistan Studies at the Middle East Institute. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.